So I'm Patrizio Mariani from the Technical University of Denmark. My background is in biological astronomy. So I'm one of the components of this very diverse group of people that we have here today. And so I've decided to use these 12 meters or 13 meters, whatever they are, to provide a general introduction to the problem of marine plankton, and then just going quickly over the results that we have obtained so far. I hope that this will stimulate some discussion later on and in the next couple of days. So I will first go and introduce some diversity in plankton lectures. I will talk a little bit and quite quickly about the diversity in phytoplankton and a bit about zooplankton diversity. And then I will focus more on zooplankton behavior with some observations and possible implications. And I will go quite quickly over the consequences of behavior in plankton, especially adaptive behavior. That's what will be my focus. So in today's audience, we have an astonishing diversity of phytoplankton life forms. We have both single-cell or multicellular organisms, often surrounded by shells that provide the form itself, the shape itself. And there are differences, not only in the shapes, circular, triangular, or whatever, but also in the structure itself, so how the structure is made and what kind of structures emerge, basically, how it is built, and gives different properties to the cells. But why do we have all these diversity out there? What are the functions of these shapes and forms? This is not a new question. It's something quite old and was actually very well explained in this book. In this book here, Art Forms of Nature by Ernest Haeckel, around 1900. He drew all these beautiful drawing of different species of phytoplankton. And do I need that?
Yes. Can you hear me? Yeah? The same. Okay. Draw all these beautiful images with different phytoplankton species and zooplankton as well, as far as I remember. And he also asked the question, why? What are they? I mean, why are all this diversity in life forms? Especially because he turned up to the conclusion that actually there is no ecological meaning for this, because there is not competitive advantage in uptake of nutrients, for example, in having these different shapes. So what are the functions of these shapes? Today we know that actually it was quite wrong, because coevolution of attack and defense systems seems to have shaped and forced the production of these different shapes in phytoplankton. And this is very well summarized by Viktor Smetacek in his Plankton Arms Race, very nice paper, 10 years ago now, the main point is that if you want to eat something like this, that is covered by this hard shell, and you want to do that, then you have to develop something that is like this. This is a detail of the mandibles of zooplankton in eating cells like this one. And what is so the take-home message is, first, that this plankton evolution is mainly ruled by protection. And second is that although there are a huge variability in this in the prey shapes and forms, the solution that actually zooplankton has found to eat them is sort of single. I mean, this structure here is the same for all copepod species, more or less. So what about zooplankton? We have a nice draw here from Erding. These are in right scales. You can see there are quite big zooplankton species and very small. This is a question of millimeters. Here we are around microns. And I mean, although the size is quite different and the ecological functions are different as well, if you take open ocean or coastal species, or also the most extreme cases of species, that's actually quite beautiful. But generally, the body plan is always like this. I mean, they are kind of all the same. So why are all the same? And are they really all the same? Not really. So my point here is that although the body plan is the same, or more or less is the same for all of them, they have evolved different strategies in order to take these three major tasks in their life: feed, survive, this one doesn't work, sorry, and reproduce. So this one is a tamara producing a feeding current, putting basically generating a small currents that put particles toward the mouth of the organism and then ingesting them. And here there was an escape response, but doesn't matter. And here are a couple of those in private situations. So the point is that if you take different species, then this feeding current here can be there or not. Often different species, they have different strategies in doing that. And reproductive as well, there is a large variability in the species using hydromechanical proxies or chemical proxies as well. So the variability, most of the variability is in the behavior. And that's the point of the talk. So I argue that the behavior is one of the most important traits that characterize the species, this group. And in particular, if you want to study it, then you have to focus. Are you standing up because 3 meters? Okay.
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Then I'll speed up a bit, because encounter rates is what we are interested in. And the point is that if you are able to make explicit the trade-off between being encountered by the predators while encountering the prey as well, then maybe we are able to model this behavior. This is the approach that we have. And then we have to include some interactions with the environment that is mainly driven by...
Move on.
Okay. Turbulence. So, in general, we recognize that we have basically two major types of encounters. They are summarized in this ballistic and diffusive. To explain quickly what it is, if you look at this guy here, it's basically moving in a straight line, and while doing this, he's encountering food. This is an example of ballistic encounter, because he's exploring a lot of water, a big volume of water. While if you look at bacteria movement, for example, encountering a marine snow here, there are more, there are a lot of tumbling while moving. And then at that scale, the motion of the bacteria can be very well described by a kind of diffusive encounter. And the other reason is that the diffusive encounter is much less efficient than the ballistic encounter. So for the same characteristic of the organism, the diffusive will provide less encounters than the ballistic one. So we can speculate then that this guy over here, that is like the meat in the sandwich, we have prey here, and the predator over here that is eating on this guy. So ideally, he will have evolved a behavior that is to have a ballistic encounter with the prey, but diffusive with the predator. So we can, using encounter rates, we can summarize this and say that the length scale of motility should be around this variation here. And this fits quite well with the observation. So support the hypothesis that the evolutionary constraints in shaping the behavior for these organisms. They are quite small, but they have a behavior, apparently. So can we model the behavior? We use Akarcha to do that. Akarcha is quite interesting because it shows two different feeding modes. Just changing the prey, the offering different kind of prey, especially motile prey or non-motile prey. In the case they are they have non-motile prey, then they make these feeding currents, like tamara we have seen before. And doing that, they translate in the fluid. If motile space is offered, then they stay just motionless in the water until some prey approach the Akarcha, and then they can recognize it with some hydromechanical stimulus, and then they jump toward the prey. Two different feeding modes, two different models for this. If we combine all of them, and we put, let's say, a fitness function as a function of the, it's the fraction of motile prey. We have 0, 1, 0 here, and 1 over here. 0 is that all the prey are non-motile. 1, all the prey are motile. And here we have prey concentrations. Obviously, increasing the prey concentrations, we will increase the fitness function, but at different rates for motile and non-motile one. The interesting part is that at certain concentrations, if you move along this line, the color here is the velocity, by the way, sorry, the optimal velocity. So it's the velocity where the maximum of the fitness is. You can see here, this is a non-viable region, so they do not survive. Here they move quite fast. Here they decrease the velocity. But along these two lines, there is actually a switch. So the decrease of velocity until a given threshold, and then they just move motionless. So it seems that we are able to capture, with a very simple model, the dynamic of the switching behavior in a Akarcha. And the message is that the interactions rates here, the feeding interactions, are totally different from the feeding interactions rate in a culture at this point. So these two strategies, actually, they have a quite strong effect in the interactions between predator and prey. And then the prey abundance, increasing prey abundance, that not always correspond to higher ingestion rate since this behavioral switching. So we should expect some population effect on it. And we do it with the, well, first, how these rates can change. So if you want to plot, for example, the ingestion rates as a function of environmental parameters, that could be turbulence, like here. This is the log 10 of the dissipation rates. And this is the log 10 of the abundance of predators in the medium. What we see is that this is the clearance rate, a measure of how much water they are able to scan and feed on. So what we get is that this value is not constant, but it's actually not even a simple function, but it's actually quite as a landscape somehow. And the important thing is that there is a quite a strong decrease in the clearance rate from low to high predator abundance, so moving along this line here. So if we introduce these changes, these adaptive changes into our population dynamics, what will happen? And we did that for a very common studied system, intraguild predation. Someone in this room may be very expert on that. And back. So we have a top predator, a consumer, and a resource. And the top predator is feeding also on the resource. Then the strength of this one will define some of the properties of the system we are using. So if we plot the omnivory factor, so the strength of this line here, against the omnivory efficiency, that is how much of this biomass is actually transferred to the top predator, and we plot the phase plot. So in this white region here, all three species are surviving, so they coexist in this region here, while in the gray region here, one between the predator and the consumer will go extinct. And in the yellow region here, we have a lot of oscillations driven by population dynamics, and also chaos exposed by this omnivore system. So the point is that increasing omnivory factor, you move from a kind of stable area into both oscillatory regime or extinction regime. If we add this adaptive behavior, then what you obtain is that this part, the gray region, didn't change too much, at least. But all the oscillatory part and the chaotic regime, I'm finished, this is my last slide, is basically done, out of the system. So there is a damping effect, we call it damping out of chaos in intraguild predation due to this adaptive behavior. So conclusion. Coevolution of attack and defense systems seems to be a driving force in natural selection of marine plankton leading to speciation. This is true for terrestrial plants, and seems to be true for marine plankton as well. Inzooplankton behavior is a major trait that can be used to distinguish different species and their ecological functions. Copepod's behavior seems to be, can be described at least by a model of the encounter rates within different prey. And adaptive behavior in zooplankton powers the existence of interacting species that would otherwise be driven to extinction. And we have used this omnivory system as a example for that. Thanks a lot of people, especially Thomas Kerb, that is the one that collects all these beautiful images, and Andy Visser and Simone, that is actually here and will talk later on today, and Ken Anderson. And thanks to you for listening.
Okay, thank you very much. We have time for a couple of questions.
So how many copepod species are there? Give or take.
I know you.
Just thousands, millions?
Yeah, it's around thousands, I would say. But then it's also quite difficult to define the species at that level, because...
But what I'm wondering is, with that many species, can they really partition all the behavioral space such that they can be all discriminated based on behavior? Or you have big classes that all have similar types of behaviors, in which case that wouldn't be the major contributor or the only contributor to diversity.
Yeah, that's true. We have big classes. At least that's my take on it. Another minor differences, especially in the swimming behavior, that can actually provide major differences in the interactions with predator and prey that actually could be a method to have speciation. But in principle, I think motile, non-motile, these are the major classes that we have out there.
So presumably behavior interacts with a series of other things to drive speciation.
Yeah. So I don't have an answer for that, actually, why do we have this speciation? Yes.
What is the size range of these
quite narrow, I would say, because it goes between 500 microns, 300 microns maybe, up to a couple of millimeters. Few species, very few species, can be up to 6 millimeters maybe. But in the copepods, the range is very narrow and seems to match, actually, the range of the physical environment. So in the physical environment, at that scale is mainly driven by turbulence. So there is this cascade effect from where the energy goes into the system and then cascades down at smaller and smaller scales. And the size of zooplankton is just at the boundary between a viscous layer and an inertial layer. So there might be something there that we don't really understand yet.
Well, I think we'll have to move on. Thank you very much.